Morning, everybody. Afternoon, evening, whatever it is, wherever you are, worldwide. This indeed is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Bernard Heisch is an astrophysicist. He's an author of over 130 scientific publications, so he has not perished. He serves as a scientific editor of the Astrophysical Journal. He did that for 10 years. Was principal investigator on several NASA research projects. His professional positions include staff scientist at the Lockheed Martin Solar and Astrophysics Laboratory and deputy director of the Center for Extreme Ultraviolet Astrophysics at the University of California. Good heavens. Of course, in Berkeley. And in addition, he was also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. Now, those are heavy, heavy-duty credentials. And what is he here to talk about? Well, we're about to find out. His book, The God Theory, Universes, Zero-Point Fields, and What's Behind It All. It's quite a claim of territory to be covering in an interview like this with a resume like that. In a moment, Dr. Heisch. Dr. Bernard Heisch, welcome to the program.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here tonight.
It's amazing to have you here tonight. Now, I've interviewed, oh my gosh, every manner of doctor and scientist and theoretical physicist and physicists and you name it, I've interviewed them over the years. I generally, somewhere in the interview, doctor, I get to the point where I ask them if they believe in a creator. It's a difficult question for them. They don't like it, and they usually politely either sidestep it or give me a no, or just a flat no, depending on their degree of honesty. Frankly, most scientists, most doctors do not believe in God.
Well, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely
right. Yeah, I know. Why?
Well, 93% of the members of the National Academy of Sciences reject God. But still, to their credit, the Academy did issue a statement saying that whether or not there's a purpose in the universe or a purpose for human existence or whether or not God exists, those are questions that science can't answer. Science must remain neutral about those. So that's the official position. But you're right that most scientists just don't want to have anything to do with the idea of a God that might lie behind the universe.
Why?
Well, that's a good question. I think some of it has to do with the antipathy between science and religion going back decades. I mean, after all, there was a persecution beginning with Galileo. Bruno was burned at the stake. The relationship between the church and scientists of the 17th century and so on was not very good. So I think that has a lot to do with it. There's a lot of, I think that science is still reacting to outmoded ideas of God. I think it's possible to conceptualize a God that is compatible with science. And I guess that's what I'm here to talk about tonight.
Good. I absolutely agree with you. I think they are compatible, and that's why the big why. There are many things in this world we still do not understand, and we cannot explain, and they seem as magic to us, some of them, including a lot of operations of the human brain, although I guess we're closing in on some of it. But as the metaphysical and science sort of move along their separate tracks, I've been noticing in recent years that they've actually, even though they don't want to, they seem to be getting closer together on some subjects.
Well, I think there's a good reason for that. There have been some remarkable discoveries in astrophysics over the last 20 years or so, say. We've discovered that there are a lot of laws of the universe that seem to be amazingly just right for life to evolve. That is, there are certain properties of the universe that, for all we know, could have been slightly different or even radically different, but if they were, we wouldn't be here. So that poses a problem. Now, it is possible to explain that away, and that's what most scientists prefer to do, to say, well, if that's the case, and we know it's the case now that the universe has some amazingly just right properties, if that's the case, that implies there must be trillions and trillions of different universes that we can never detect just so that ours isn't really special, just so that ours is part of a statistical ensemble and it's not really special. So you have to create a lot of hypothetical universes, perhaps even an infinite number, to explain it away. And I'm simply proposing in my book, The God Theory, that it's equally logical, equally rational, to assume that maybe there is an intelligence behind the universe. And that's the reason that we have the special properties that let life evolve and that let new life forms develop according to the laws of evolution and so on.
So the God theory is that, explain it again to me, the God theory is?
It's that there is an intelligence behind the universe. And then I go on to discuss what the reasons for that might be. And those go back to the discoveries that the universe seems to have some just right properties. For example, there are at least half a dozen I could name having to do with the strength of the nuclear force, the strength of the gravitational force, the amount of dark energy and dark matter, and peculiar properties of carbon and so on.
Does your theory, Doctor, allow for the possibility that there is other intelligent life on a par with us, or perhaps even greatly more evolved than we are somewhere out there?
Oh, almost certainly. I mean, that's something I think that most astronomers would grant, that probably there are other civilizations in the universe. After all, there are at least 100 billion stars in our galaxy, at least 100 billion galaxies in our universe, and so we're discovering planets around other stars several per month. I think pretty much the consensus in astronomy is that there must be lots of civilizations out there in the universe. The issue, of course, is whether we'll ever be able to communicate with them or be in touch with them or ever be able to travel to other star systems. That's the question. But that there are other civilizations out there, I think that's pretty much taken for granted, although, of course, we have no direct evidence of that yet.
What is your feeling? As you point out, there are so many stars, so many planets. We now discover them, as you point out, daily or weekly, the bigger ones, and that implies there's also smaller ones. And so at the right distance from a sun, it's almost inevitable, it seems, unless life is utterly rare to the point that it's only here, that it has evolved in many places. And yet SETI has found nothing. We've had no signals. Of course, we have lots of, sort of evidence with all these UFO sightings and the abduction stories. I just had a really good one last week, and we have that, but it's not hard put your finger on it evidence yet.
That's right, and that's the problem. For scientists, you need the hard put your finger on evidence, the forensic evidence, and unfortunately, we just don't have that today. But to your question about detection of other civilizations with SETI, you know, you're making quite an assumption in SETI that radio communications, which we have served us well for only about a century or so, that kind of technology would persist and become a dominant mechanism of communication. And that may simply not be correct. I mean, we could have a universe, even a galaxy, even a local neighborhood of stars full of life, and maybe discover someday that they've moved well beyond radio communications eons ago. So we may just be asking the wrong questions when we do radio searches. But then again, who knows?
Certainly, you're correct. Can you imagine what other form of communication might evolve past radio and television and the electromagnetic medium?
Well, this is jumping in kind of far into the book, but it's my suspicion that ultimately we'll discover that probably it's consciousness that lies behind the universe.
Bingo!
The consciousness of an infinite intelligence. And I think ultimately we'll find that we ourselves are manifestations of that consciousness. And so it may be that in the future what we use to communicate will have nothing to do with electromagnetism or some of the laws of physics that we know now, but may have to do with other laws that deal with the nature of our own consciousness. But that's taking us pretty deeply into areas that are, at this point, this stage in our knowledge, very speculative.
Well, they are, but there is some work going on. I guess you, if you believe that, then you have been following the work at Princeton and elsewhere on consciousness.
Yes, indeed. I know those people pretty well. Bob John, Brenda Dunn, Roger Nelson. I've worked with those people. I even accepted and published their papers in the Journal of Scientific Exploration.
Oh, Doctor, I think that is extremely exciting. I made a statement on the air a number of years ago after I did a series of experiments. Have you heard of those? Probably you haven't.
I don't know which ones you're referring to.
Okay. I did a series of experiments with Mr. Nelson and Dr. Nelson and others. And in those experiments, I, for example, took areas of the country. You know, I have access here to millions of people. And it was reckless, I now feel. But at the time, I looked for areas that had drought, hadn't had rain in months and months and months. I really did this, doctor. And I just took time out and asked my listeners, millions of them, to concentrate on forming clouds, on forming moisture, in fact, on causing rain. I did a total of 11 experiments, doctor. And in each case, we caused, within an hour, doctor, we caused rain in areas that had not seen it in months every single time. We also worked on some health issues for people. I mean, we did some amazing things. They were so amazing, doctor, that they scared the hell out of me. People began emailing me and saying things like, okay, let's take a hurricane that's headed toward the coast and divert it. And I know there's a lot for you to swallow right now, but I can assure you, I'm doing so on the air, we really did this. And that's when I stopped. I said, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. This is obviously a power. What we have done has worked. We caused rain in Texas, in fact, floods. We caused rain in the Northwest that had been bereft of rain for months. And many other areas, and it worked, and it scared me, doctor. It actually scared me. I would tell people, close your eyes during this next break. We'll all give it a try, millions of us at once. The people cooperated. It really happened. And then I realized I had no idea. It was a real power, obviously, because it was working, or it was a series of coincidences that, I don't know, the numbers for it would be off the chart. So it worked, and it scared me, and I said, I'm going to stop, because what if, since I don't know what I'm doing, we, for example, divert a hurricane away from the coast, giving it more time over the water, and then the damn thing circles back, now being a Category 5 when it was only a 1 or 2 before. So, you know, the old toying with Mother Nature thing. I really did those experiments, doctor. They really worked, and at the end of it all, I said, I'm stopping. I'm not going to do it anymore. Until I understand it, which I may not ever in my lifetime. And in fact, we even did one with the cooperation of the folks at Princeton, and we caused their little eggs to go berserk just as an experiment, and it worked.
Well,
and if you
amazing.
Look over, if you look, doctor, over the record of what they've done at Princeton with 9/11 and all the rest of it, and all this occurring before the actual incident, you've got to believe that what you're onto when you mention consciousness, this is something real. And I said, you know, someday we may find that consciousness in its own way has more power than the atomic bomb, atomic energy.
Well, that could be ultimately. It is a dangerous thing, because if we do have such powers, I mean, think of how they could be misused. I think that the fact that our consciousness operates in a very limited kind of way in terms of the things you're talking about is probably essential for human civilization to exist, because of the old maxim, be careful what you wish for, you might get it. Now, the importance of the Princeton work is that the effects that they found were extremely tiny, but they were tiny and yet backed up by statistics. I mean, the people at Princeton were very careful about analyzing their data, and while they found very minute results, they did find results that could be backed up statistically. So I think their work is pretty impressive.
Well, I guess it all walks with the quantum world, right?
I guess so.
So I completely agree with you. I'm not sure how all of this fits in with spirituality, with religion. How do you feel, for example, about organized religion?
Well, organized religion is a problem. Recently, I had the chance to read Sam Harris's book, The Letter to a Christian Nation. And I thought, well, I'll read this. It'll probably annoy me, but I'll read it. I should read it. After all, it's presenting a very different view than my book, so I better find out what he talks about. And I found myself agreeing with about 90% of it, because what he's doing is pointing out some of the absurdities and, in fact, some of the dangers of organized religions. There are things that you find in the Bible that, you know, I certainly would not want to attribute to any kind of benevolent God. And so I find that religions are something that perhaps I'm hopeful that mankind will ultimately grow out of, but not because there isn't a God or because we're not spiritual beings, but rather because religion has the capability to be misused by human beings, misused to generate hatred, intolerance, religious wars, persecutions. It simply has a lot of potential for mischief. And if you look in the Mideast, you know, you find yourself facing a situation in which people are slaughtering each other simply because of differences in within the same religion. And so the absurdity to which religion can be carried by human beings is quite amazing. On the other hand, religion and spirituality are not necessarily bound together. My suspicion is that we're all spiritual beings, but that our spiritual nature is something that will be subject to scientific study eventually. I hope spirituality becomes part of the branches of knowledge alongside of astronomy and biology and physics someday.
If all organized religion suddenly ceased to be, I've always thought that organized religion had a purpose, and that purpose was to keep control of people. In other words, a lot of people, it seems, refrain from doing something that would be considered evil or bad because their organized religion tells them that. Now, if suddenly all those restrictions and barriers were removed, what do you think would be the social result?
Well, if removed too quickly, probably you would have negative consequences. But my belief is that, I shouldn't say belief, actually, I'm a scientist after all, and so I should say my suspicion is that we are really spiritual beings living in physical bodies. And our spiritual nature is one that we share with whatever intelligence made our universe. And as spiritual beings, I think that there are certain laws that go along with that, one of them being the concept of karma. I think that the things that we do as spiritual beings are things that will have consequences for us, and you can't dodge the bullet of responsibility for things that you do. So if we actually believed that the actions of our lives and the effects on other people were things that we would have to eventually be rewarded for, or we would have to account for in some way, that would change the world. It really would change the world if we believe wholeheartedly that we can't just with impunity commit crimes, murder, damage to other people. That would change the world if we truly believed there was a law of karma that would make things eventually balance out and come back upon us.
There was a man who wrote a book called The God Part of the Brain, Doctor. And his theory was that there is a part of our brain that virtually demands that we worship something. And if you go to, for example, I mean, here in the Philippines, there are some areas that man almost hasn't been to here in the Philippines, some islands where you go and inevitably they worship something, the sun or something. So you can go to parts of the world, perhaps in Brazil, perhaps in other remote areas of the world. Inevitably, you find these natives worshiping something. Do you think there is a part of our brain that demands this?
Well, I personally don't. I think that it has to do with our consciousness rather than our brain. And I tend to separate the two because it seems to me that the brain is not necessarily the source of our consciousness. Rather, it may be the vehicle by which our consciousness interacts with our immortal bodies. But I don't take the brain and the biochemistry of the brain to be the explanation of who we are as human beings, of what our consciousness is all about. I think there are deeper explanations that we could find by delving into the reports of the mystics and the esoteric traditions within the various religions. I think that there is much more to us as human beings than simply as chemical machines that are driven by neurophysiology and processes in the brain. I think we have to look much deeper than that. And that's not a view that's very popular in science at the moment, but I think eventually as we begin to explore consciousness more and more in this century, we'll come to find that it's a necessity that we look elsewhere for what causes our own consciousness rather than simply looking to the chemistry of our brain.
So you don't feel that you can define consciousness, or do you?
Well, I think consciousness is something that we have inherited from and share with the intelligence that stands behind the universe.
Sir James, in other words, God.
I would say God, yes. The intelligence the supreme intelligence, transcendent intelligence, call it God. We're talking about
all right,
the same
all right.
Thing.
Doctor, hold it right there. We're at a break point. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. So consciousness, in a sense, equals God. I could probably get kind of next to that theory. We're going to talk about this fascinating stuff. Dr. Bernard Heisch is my guest. Now, I want you to remember, we're talking to a man who, a scientist. You just don't hear this kind of thing from scientists. An astrophysicist, a man who's worked with, headed NASA projects, a man who you just would not expect to hear this sort of thing from. So we're going to explore this in detail. Stay right where you are. Just very quickly, because I think it's going to fit into what we're talking about here in a moment. I rarely recommend movies or books unless they're just over the top. But I must tell you, the other day I went out and rented a DVD that I had not previously seen called AI, Artificial Intelligence. AI is the name of the movie. If you have not yet seen that, oh my God, go out and rent it or buy it or whatever and look at it. And it just knocked me right off the couch. AI. Doctor, welcome back. And so it's an oversimplification, but in a sense then, our consciousness equals the God within us, or the God.
I think that's right. I think basically our consciousness is the same as that of God, except of course it's been attenuated by the fact that it has to deal with and reside in mortal bodies. So it's just a tiny, tiny fraction of that infinite consciousness, but I think it is the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's even some evidence that this is we're going along the right path by considering consciousness to be something like that, something we share with the intelligence behind the universe. Aldous Huxley wrote about his experience in the 1950s with the drug mescaline. He had one very intense experience in which this drug, which is the same one used by the Indians in their ceremonies, Native American ceremonies, he used the drug to put himself into an altered state, and then he tried to describe what that world was like, because he was in a different reality for several hours. And he wasn't, of course, entirely successful, because he had to use the words of one world to describe the feelings in another. His explanation was that he viewed the brain as a filter of consciousness rather than as a source of consciousness. And by that, I mean that he was assuming that perhaps his consciousness was tuned to that of a universal one, that of a creative intelligence behind the universe. And when he took the drug, it put a crack in his mental filter. And he was able to see things and experience things that he wouldn't ordinarily be able to, because his brain was not filtering out that vast amount of consciousness that is the sea of all consciousness. And that was a very interesting idea that suggested to me that maybe there's evidence in the behavior of autistic savants. You know, autistic savants are people who sometimes can't do the most simple things like tie their shoes, and yet they can mm-hmm. do the most amazing things that you wouldn't expect a human being to be able to do.
Yes.
I'll give you some examples. Leslie Lemke was an autistic savant who played Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 after a single listen without having had a piano lesson. Daniel Tammet cannot tell left from right, but he can multiply two huge numbers in his head while talking to you. Moreover, he recited the value of pi to 21,514 decimal places.
My God.
Now, this is an amazing thing. I couldn't imagine memorizing the value of pi to those number of decimal places. And by the way, it goes on to infinity. Pi never stops. But 22,514 decimal places. And he did that not by some kind of mental calculation, as he reported, but by seeing forms in his head. He visualized shapes in his head, and they told him what the next value of pi was. And then lastly, Kim Peek, who was the model for Dustin Hoffman's Rain Man. He can read two pages simultaneously, of course, one with each eye. He has perfect recall of 8,000 books, and for recreation, he memorizes telephone directories.
Aye.
These are things that I don't think, or I would say a human being can't do, except they've been done. And the common factor among these three people and all autistic savants is that they all suffer some form of brain damage. And so this is very neatly dovetails with Aldous Huxley's idea of the brain as a filter rather than a source of consciousness. The autistic savants, in my view, may be showing evidence that they're tuning in to a universal knowledge that we all have access to, except we have to filter out most of it to exist in the everyday world.
Now, is this something that you contend would be unique to human beings? Or if we eventually develop artificial intelligence, if we get enough memory, enough speed, processing speed, whatever it is that it takes, do you think we will ever actually develop an artificial intelligence that possesses consciousness? Or is that something that is in God's territory, and no matter the speed in the storage, it will never happen?
Well, that's a tricky question, because it seems to me there is the possibility that if you manufactured an artificial intelligence that was sophisticated enough, interesting enough, capable enough, that could serve as sort of an artificial life form, and the universal intelligence might decide, indeed, that's an experience worth having, and therefore consciousness could enter into that artificial intelligence the same way that I think it does into human beings and animals and so on. So it may become the host of consciousness, but the question is the consciousness coming from within that machine, emerging from it, or is the consciousness coming from the outside deciding, gee, this is a very interesting experience to have, let me experience what it's like to be an artificial intelligence in this universe?
All right. Now we're going to get into some difficult territory, and this is something I've thought a lot about. I've read the Bible, Doctor, and I would imagine you've probably at least read some of it, if not all of it. And there is so much recorded in there, Doctor. There is so much information in there. Was that all? I mean, the miracles, the Jesus who walked Earth, all of that that forms the basis of our organized religion in the West, and then others like Jesus who became the basis of other religions around the world. Is all of that cooked up by man?
Well, some of it does seem to be. I'm really bothered by some of the things that I do find in the Bible. Let me give you an example. This is out of Deuteronomy. There is the statement that if a man discovers on his wedding night that his bride is not a virgin, he must stone her to death on her father's doorstep. That's in Deuteronomy. Now, I don't believe God wrote that. Any God who would write that is not any kind of God that I could worship. And so I just don't believe that that's a God-given commandment. And yet, there it is in Deuteronomy. And unfortunately, the Bible is full of things like this, things that we would reject today as being immoral, as being, in some cases, utterly inhumane, and yet they're in the Bible. So you have to be very careful about how you attribute the authorship of the Bible and the purpose of the Bible. And that's where I find myself in agreement with some of the criticisms of people like Sam Harris, for example, who does give some very cogent examples of things that you find in the Bible that simply are not the kind of thing you would expect of any God that's worthy of belief.
And then, of course, there's creation itself, Doctor. For example, I've interviewed many religious creationists, and from their point of view, we have been here no longer than 6,000 years. And, of course, we were placed here by God. Now, I think that science has done a job on that theory, a complete job. I mean, obviously, we have evolved. I don't think there's a whole lot of dissent from that. There is some, and the dissent that is there is very, very vocal. So perhaps you'd like to comment a bit on the whole concept of creation versus evolution.
I would, because the theory I'm proposing, first of all, has nothing to do with intelligent design. When I talk about a God behind the universe, I'm thinking of a God whose ideas perhaps became our laws of nature, whose ideas became our physical constants. And this is a notion that goes back to the early 1930s when Sir James Jeans, who was one of the great astrophysicists of that era, In fact, he even has a crater on the moon named after him, and he was knighted for his work. He wrote a book called The Mysterious Universe. And in it, he wrote that the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. And so to him, the universe seemed more like a thought. And this led me to think that perhaps these fundamental principles of the universe that are very conducive to life may well be the thoughts of a great intelligence. And that great intelligence would dream up a universe. Why? Probably because that intelligence would like to experience some of its potential. And that potential is best experienced by entering into the life forms that arise in our universe and perhaps others. And that's where evolution comes in, because I think evolution is a tremendously good way to let new things arise, to let new life forms come into being. And I think the purpose of the creator is to experience novelty, not to manufacture a cookie-cutter universe, not to manufacture creatures designed by intelligent design, but rather to have a universe whose basic laws are set. Let a Big Bang become the origin of that universe. Let evolution take place over billions of years. Let life forms arise. And then let intelligence, let consciousness enter into those life forms and experience physical reality. That's what I suspect it's all about. And that's totally consistent with what we know of a 13.7 billion-year-old Earth and evolution taking place and resulting in the life forms eventually leading to us on this planet.
I have interviewed many theoretical physicists who believe that it's very likely that the reason we have not yet encountered other intelligent life, at least to a level of proof, a bar that they're willing to accept, is that when life emerges, it gets to the point roughly where we are now, where it has discovered and begun to apply the uses of element 92, where it begins to perhaps even approach the quantum era, and life inevitably cyclically destroys itself or is destroyed by some cosmic event like a big rock.
Well, I certainly hope that's not true. In our case, you know, it could certainly go either way, given our past history and our current abilities and our current abilities of religions to foster hatred and intolerance among different groups. Mm-hmm. So our example is not that optimistic a one, although I myself suspect that we will get through this. But whether or not that applies to other civilizations, certainly you can't assume that's any kind of universal law.
And so why are you that optimistic?
Well, we've made it through some pretty bad times already. Religions have been the source of problems for a long time. People have been persecuted. Millions of people have been slaughtered in wars. And we're still here, and we have a world that is more advanced than ever before. Perhaps it's just that intrinsically there's a certain amount of optimism. I can't really prove it, can I?
No, and I think that I'm a pessimist. I think the larger possibility is self-destruction. Now, we've not been in that time where we had the ability to destroy ourselves for very long in the larger scheme of things. That's all pretty new to us. But I worry that nuclear weapons, or perhaps even scarier, biological weapons, and all the other things that we face these days that could literally mean the end of the world, or at least the end of man on world, is a better way to put it, can be set loose. And we certainly seem to have no shortage of people willing to strap whatever it is around their belly and take themselves and as many others out as they can.
That's right. And I think that's, in fact, well, to be frank, that's, in fact, the reason I wrote my book. Because I think it's essential to have some kind of a concept of God that makes sense scientifically and that takes us away from the narrow views of God that cause the kind of rivalry and hatred that we're seeing in the world today. Visions of God that call for destruction and violence, visions of God that picture him as if he were some desert patriarch, hungry for worship and eager for slaughter. That's an idea we have to put behind us, because that is what could take the world to its ultimate destruction. I think that it's entirely possible, though, to conceive of a God that's not like that, that has a purpose in creating a universe, that has a purpose for our lives, and that is consistent with science. And so you have this you have this middle ground I'm trying to appeal to, the people that don't want the fundamentalist notions of God that foster hatred, and yet they are perhaps too much under the sway of scientists who argue, well, we've proven there is no God, which, of course, is not mm-hmm. the case. Science can't prove that one right. way or the other. Right. And I'm proposing a middle ground that's based upon a concept of our own spiritual nature, but not one that's tied to any religion, because the religions, they can't be right because there are so many of them and they disagree. So are we to say that one is right and the rest are wrong? I don't find that possible.
Doctor, does your theory of a creative force, God, include the probability of an afterlife?
I think it's not just a probability. I think it's built into the theory, because if we really are sparks of an infinite consciousness, then almost by definition, that consciousness can't die. And so if that's what we truly are, consciousness inhabiting physical bodies, then it becomes a moot point. We can't possibly die, because how could that consciousness die if it's part of the infinite intelligence? Mm-hmm. I think that a statement by Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit paleontologist, says it quite well. He wrote, "Surely we are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a human experience." And if that's the case, then I think it becomes almost self-evident that indeed when we die, we transition into some other realm where consciousness resides, but that we probably come back again, and that's probably the purpose. It's probably the purpose of being in this universe, to have experience and to give.
Now,
God,
that was going to be my
experience.
Next question. In what manner do you imagine consciousness to continue? And I guess your answer is reincarnation of some sort.
I guess I would say that, yes. I think that, what sense would it make for consciousness to come into this universe, inhabit a body, live 80 years of life, say, in Bakersfield, and then be over and done with, because the universe is 13.7 billion years old. So it doesn't make a great deal of sense to me to assume you come into life once. You may be born into a life that is plagued with problems. You may be born into a life that gives you untold wealth. And all these injustices make it look as if the whole thing is simply a very unfair game. I think mm-hmm. that if you look upon the possibility that there are multiple lives that we live, then the circumstances of an individual life take on a very different character. The injustice that seems to go along with human experience has a different perspective if you look upon the possibility that we come back more than once and that we live other lives.
It's my understanding that reincarnation actually was part of the Bible at one time, and the Council of Nicaea removed it. Had you heard that?
I have heard that, but I've got to say I've not studied that, so I've heard it, but I can't swear by that.
I also tend, as you do, to believe that reincarnation may be the way consciousness would propagate, but there is a problem with it too, and that is, what sense does consciousness reincarnated without any conscious memory make?
Well, I think the conscious memory, the lack of conscious memory, is sort of part of what you need to have a novel experience. Let's assume, for example, that you did have a number of lives behind you, and you came into a new life fresh, and the idea was to experience this new life to its fullest. If you were burdened and saddled with that past knowledge, the decisions you make wouldn't necessarily be free and novel decisions. I think that we're given an opportunity in any given life to do things in an independent way, to be unburdened from our past. And I think that if we indeed are the supreme intelligence experiencing physical reality, it's essential to forget who we are, because if we remembered who we were, namely sparks of God, that would put a damper on the novelty of a given life. That would put a damper on the experience. It's sort of like playing a game of, say, hiding the treasure. You bury a treasure someplace, and then you find it. Well, if you buried it yourself, and then you try to find it, what fun is that? You know where it is. So you have to forget where you put the treasure if you're going to play that kind of game. And I think that's what God does when God experiences incarnation as a physical being. He forgets.
So perhaps, along with everything else, the treasure he removes is wisdom, the one thing we gain with age.
Indeed.
So we have to start the game all over again. But you're right, it's novel, and without that novelty, it just wouldn't be the same game, would it?
No, not at all.
All right. All right. This is fascinating stuff. Dr. Bernard Heisch is my guest. He's truly a hardcore scientist, but boy, he sure does have a different point of view. So leave your thinking caps on. This is going to be absolutely fascinating. From the Philippines, basically the other side of the world, I'm Art Bell.